Mr. Keel. Friends of the Concordia faculty, I might say that this takes me back to the Valparaiso days when I can recall giving a lecture here where President Fewbringer sat in the third row. At that time, was not yet the president of the seminary. And of course, since then, I've been in contact with the faculty for many years, indirectly, and have followed its developments. Maybe I should tell you a little story before I begin to give my lecture that I think is quite apropos to my situation this afternoon. This is related to a young graduate of our seminary. Let's say it is of our seminary. It may have been some other seminary. But this particular candidate was sent far west, out into the sticks. And apparently the church that he was going to serve was one of those old-fashioned ones with a central stove. And apparently quite crude in its inner appointments. Any rate, on Sunday morning, and then when he was going to preach his first sermon, he went out there and he swept the church and he built a fire on the central stove and then sat down and nobody came. So he couldn't quite understand this. And finally, a cowboy, a straggler, came in and they sat down together and waited for a while and he says, "Do you think I should preach?" Well, the cowboy said, "You know, I'm just a simple cowhand and I don't know a great deal about preaching, but I know if I were to go out and feed my cattle and only a single critter came, I think I'd feed him." Well, this encouraged him, so he started the service. When he got into the pulpit, he preached and he preached and he preached and he preached. Well, when the service was over and the cowboy was ready to leave, I suppose he was anxious, so he said, "How well did I do?" Well, the cowboy said, "You know, I told you before, I knew nothing about sermons. I'm just a simple cowhand. But I do know this, that if I were to go out and feed my cattle, and only one critter showed up, I don't think I'd throw him the whole load of hay." Well, I'm somewhat against this same problem, and I hope that I can throw the right amount of hay in order to not take too much of your time. The review of my life has sort of changed a little in regard to my address. I was going to tell you a little about myself. I didn't know that that much would be said, so we will just pass over that, and I want to start out with a kind of introductory, what shall I say, a review or evaluation of what I think is required to do actually your research in the Reformation from the right perspective. Maybe I should add just this to what was said. I think that Preservet Smith, by having me go into the matricule of the University of Wittenberg and locate the students on the map of Europe every 10 years, determining where they came from, and then also determining what they did when they went back, really gave me my life's theme. Of course, I had to spread out, you know, that there was much more to the Reformation than just the University of Wittenberg. But I did learn through this a great deal, and then I sat at the feet of Karl Becker for 3 years, who spent a great deal of time in analyzing what is an historical fact. And this really gave me new insight, because this was a secular approach to history. At Chicago and Cornell, I had, in both cases, studied history from the secular point of view. So combined with my training in church history at Capital University, made a good balance between the two. At any rate, through that I learned that really to deal with the Reformation is a tremendous problem. When I went to Ohio State to do my master's thesis on the side while I was in the seminary and worked with Dean Siebert, I really didn't realize what I was getting into. And in this research, I dug largely into secondary works and Luther's Tischreden, little realizing what kind of a body of information a person really should master in order to understand the Reformation. I never realized that Luther had written 350 tracts, the most productive scholar in Western civilization, and that the Weimar edition was 100 volumes in Latin and German, and they didn't even have the Weimar edition at Ohio State. Then that the letters of Luther in the Weimar edition are 14 volumes. In the Enders edition are 19 volumes. Then there's the Erlangen edition of 66 volumes. There's the Bach edition of 24. Then there's also the Wittenbergische Ausgabe and the Jena Ausgabe. And there are about 3,500 biographies and treatises on Luther. No wonder that Paul Althaus said, Luther is like an ocean. You can drown in him. And when I wrote this thesis then, we put it on the shelf and it's been gathering dust ever since. I've always been ashamed of it. At any rate, I think we should begin the Reformation by my analyzing briefly what some of the basic assumptions are that are necessary to really get a correct historical perspective of the Reformation. I think I have put these in no particular order so that one is probably no more important than the other. But I'm going to begin with saying that the Reformation did not begin with Luther, but it goes as far back as 1200. And when I was with the Foundation, I went to Wolfenbüttel and I analyzed some of the findings there, and I was really amazed at the amount of material that goes far back. What kind of monastic and other collections went to the Wolfenbüttel Library that were already like Luther's catechism? There were even pictorial catechisms in the Middle Ages. So that if we want to deal with this, we have to really, like Joseph Lortz said, we have to really go back to 1200. And you know that Obermann at Tübingen, together with a number of pupils, has been exploring what we might call, he called his book, The Harvest of Medieval Theology. And he's shown that really, the late Middle Ages was like an orchard with a lot of fruit in it, and you can pick what you wanted to. Number two, I think it's a mistake to assume that when Luther became the reformer that there was one Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church was more like a Barnum and Bailey show with three ring circuses going side by side. And really, it was rather hard to determine for an Erfurt student whether Erfurt was right or whether Leipzig was right in its approach. Erfurt taught the Via Moderna, and Leipzig taught the Via Antiqua. And it's interesting, I translated the Wittenberg Statutes, and in the Wittenberg Statutes it states that there are to be given at Wittenberg three courses. One is to be given viam tomi, the other one is to be given viam scoti, and the third one is to be given via moderna. And then it adds, and all three are to be given without prejudice. So three different systems. And Joseph Furtner wrote a very fine book, who was really a student of Joseph Lortz, who started that very fine school of Catholic scholars, Dominicans, and Jesuits that have done so much to restore Luther's respectability. At any rate, Furtner wrote a book called Luther and Aquinas on Salvation. in which he concludes that the Council of Trent, 1545 to 63, knew neither Aquinas nor Luther. That's a pretty strong statement for a Dominican to make. And Hertie, of that same period, in fact, his was a little earlier, Hertie wrote a book on Cochleus, and he came to the conclusion in the volumes that he put out that Luther was really terribly maligned and that Cochleus was the greatest liar of the 16th century. There's another Dominican. Well, at any rate, all I'm trying to say is that it would be wrong to assume that when Luther asked for a council, and a council to decide what he stood for, whether it was right or wrong, he had a good reason to do this, because there was no single viewpoint that you could work toward. Fact of the matter is, I might just add by way of commentary, that it was Luther's digging back into the early church and becoming acquainted with all the background of the fathers that caused him to become all the more confused, because he couldn't understand how his church of his own day could be so far removed from what was back there. Well, then, number three, I think there's another assumption that we have to make, namely that there isn't one Luther, but there were three Luthers. And to quote Luther indiscriminately, putting no time on the quotation, like Kerr did at Princeton, you do nothing but create confusion. There's a Catholic Luther who was thoroughly taught, as I'll show a little later, in the whole background of Roman Catholicism up to the doctor's degree. And then after 1514, there is an emerging reformer who gradually extricates himself of what he's learned during the previous training. And the more he learns language, the deeper he gets into it, the more he's able to actually become a New Testament exegete. So that really it is true that you have then the emerging reformer, and in some fields he's not fully clear until at least the middle 20s. So when you start quoting Luther, you can't quote 1519 on the Lord's Supper and compare it with what he says much later, because you're going to get confusion since the man has not fully matured. Then, after 1525, I suppose, we could say that we have the mature Luther, who now has an entirely new approach, and who knows Greek and Hebrew, so that he can actually stand on his own feet and do his own interpreting. And he's even, by 29, finished the translation of the Bible. So that it's not strange that this same Luther would, in that later period, have an entirely different approach. Number four assumption is that the Reformation can only be understood if you grant that it was a groundswell movement. By that I mean, there were many Catholics who absolutely agreed with Luther and who felt just like Luther did, and that's the reason it had such an appeal. You would never have had the following for Luther had it not been for the fact that were many others, and I have run into source material, like in the case of Tetzel, where even 1 year before Luther nailed his 95 Theses, a man up in Magdeburg advised a woman to get down on her knees and pray and not to buy these worthless indulgence letters. Well, then, in addition to this, I suppose we can also say that the approach to the Reformation cannot be understood if we make Luther a Lutheran. This may sound kind of striking, but nevertheless it's true. The people in the Reformation regarded themselves as Altgläubigen and Neugläubigen. It's like in the Roman Catholic Church today, many of the priests want to get married, that every bishop be the husband of one wife. And they are disturbed from New Testament exegesis with their church's position. At any rate, the Altgläubigen were perfectly satisfied with the status quo. Didn't want to make any changes. Satisfied with the Pope. The Neugläubigen began comparing the things that were being done in the church and what was being propounded from Rome. The Neugläubigen wondered whether or not this was actually in conformity with what they had done in the early church. And it's no wonder that Luther said in the Leipzig debate, the papacy is only 400 years old. And it isn't strange either that Luther held that in the early church, the whole approach was different. So that we can understand Luther only and the Reformation if we grant that this basic difference is there. Luther wrote a letter to one of his friends and said, don't call yourselves Lutherans. Who's Luther that you should name yourself after him? St. Paul didn't want his followers to be called Paulinians. Call yourselves Christians. And Luther distinguished very carefully between the German Gemeinde and the communion of saints. He saw that there was only one church. He didn't think he was founding a new church. He was restoring the church. He was restoring by sweeping out the abuses of the Middle Ages and going back to the apostolic environment. Finally, the Reformation, in my opinion, after spending 55 years of research in this field, is that the Reformation was really a university movement. It involves not just Luther. Luther is the general. But it involves 16,292 students from 1520 to 1560. And I placed them on the map of Europe, and they come from Transylvania, they come from Hungary, they come from all over. And then they go back and establish congregations, and they flourish in many cases. Like at Breslau, there was one graduate from Wittenberg that went there and then had actually control over something like 30 congregations in the area that were Wittenberg graduates. So you can see that from that the movement is not simple, but very complex, because Luther was able to win the Wittenberg faculty to his point of view. And so in the classrooms, you had an approach that really brought about the Reformation, also in the university. And so students, no matter what field they were in, even in law and in medicine, they were oriented toward this new approach. I suppose that the next thing that I should do is to just briefly analyze the early life of Martin Luther, the formative period of Martin Luther. In my new book, I have actually gone into all the old medieval chronicles at Princeton and translated them. Like the Rheinhausbrunnen in Nalen was actually the monastic center where the princes were buried, and they kept a very careful record of the whole history of Thuringia. For example, how was the Wartburg started? They tell that whole story. And they tell about Thuringia being, you might say, under the guidance of the Ludovinger, and that begins around 911 and runs all the way through to 1250. And then when Meissen takes over, you have another line that is directly related to this group because they've intermarried. So I've tried to bring all that together, the history of Saxony, the history of Thuringia, in my new book, but this is now the region that I'm describing here. I was not able to find anything that referred to Luther's ancestry, but I do know that they had five Höfe right near the Wartburg in that region, near Eisenach, and that they were Erbsenzleute. That meant that they were in a system of feudalism directly under the Duke of Henneberg, and they had a special arrangement where the youngest boy inherited all the property of the family. So Luther's father would not inherit the property, so he looked around, and it so happened that in this period, and that's another thing that I've gone into in the new book, it happened that there was like a gold rush to California in regard to mining. It's just surprising how much gold, silver, copper, and other metals were mined in these regions, and how this made the princes of Saxony very wealthy. That's the reason why Frederick the Wise was able to build the castle church. He didn't even have to worry about hiring first-class artists to decorate it, because they had made an arrangement, for example, in the Erzgebirge, to actually, get a certain percentage of income. They had even their own officials, that when gold was mined, how much of the gold would flow into the coffers of Elector Saxony. So Luther's father apparently looked around. He said, well, maybe my future lies when I go up to near the Hartz Mountains and get into the mining business as a copper miner. And so it is true that he did this and became very prosperous. I might say that the grandfather, Heine Luther, had married Margareta Lindemann, and they had four sons, Großhans, Kleinhans, Veit, and Heinz. I don't know why they called the second one Kleinhans, because that would be very confusing, except that he must have been fairly small when the other one had already grown quite a little. Großhans and Kleinhans. Well, now, Catholics have very often poked fun at Luther's father because they've mixed him up with Kleinhans. Kleinhans was an alcoholic, and when he drank, he became pugnacious, beat up on people. And so it kind of gave Luther's father kind of a black eye in the so far that he was blamed for things that the brother did. Well, I haven't time to go into any kind of detail about this, but I would like to point out that Luther's father was not poor, like very often our biographies have claimed. Luther's father was quite wealthy. He had two mine shafts, copper mine shafts, of his own. When he came to the primus of his son in the Augustinian monastery, he paid at least $1,000 as a lump of sum just to show his goodwill, and he came there with 20 horsemen. He already, when Luther was only a boy of about 8, was already one of the prominent citizens of Mansfeld, one of the 4 citizens in charge of 1/4 of the town. So you can see that his background was one in which the father really was quite successful. And therefore, the father was very anxious to have his son become a prominent lawyer, and even had picked out a girl that he was supposed to marry. Well, we all know that he was sent to 3 different schools, and we haven't time to go into the instruction on those schools, but they were good schools. Mansfeld was good enough that 33 in the matricule of Wittenberg, I found, were graduates of Mansfeld and matriculated directly from there into the university. So it must not have been too bad a school. Why he was sent to Magdeburg, we don't know, where he worked with a Nolbruthen for a while. But 1 year later, he was sent to Eisenach to complete his academic training for the university. And of course, that was one of the finest schools in that part of Germany. So the preparatory schools then prepared Luther very well in practically all the disciplines. He was even very prominent in music, and one find in the Berlin Library has revealed that even there, he was a composer. We have some of the material to prove that he composed music even as a student at Eisenach. Well, when he went to Erfurt then, we don't quite know why he was sent to Erfurt, why he wasn't sent to Leipzig, But at any rate, he was sent to Erfurt, and there he was an outstanding student and was able to get his bachelor's and master's degrees in record time. Studied with the two prominent professors, Trutwetter and Usingen, who were supposed to be some of the best in that day in the Via Moderna. Then, for some unexpected reason, Luther enters the monastery. There has never been a satisfactory explanation. My explanation is that when Luther was staying with the Schaubers, tutoring young Heini Schauber in Eisenach, and Frau Kata was so interested in his music when he sang There's a Choir Boy, on Sundays they would get together, either in the Kata or the Schauber home, and a young Franciscan from the foot of the Wartburg would come there, and for about 3 years, apparently he must have had a lot of conversations with Luther. I noticed that in the Weimar edition letters, one of the first ones that Luther wrote to invite members to the Primus was this Vicar Brown from that small monastic center. So I have concluded that I grant that the events that are ascribed to this, whether it was that he was in a thunderstorm or whether there were other explanations, I agree with Heinrich Stroll that really what it did brought out what was in Luther's heart. He was already apparently very dissatisfied with the way things were going, and he was hoping to find a solution in the monastery. Well, we know that he went into the monastery, and then the professors, realizing what kind of a student he was, they immediately began to arrange for him in the monastery to take advanced degrees. See, he already had his master's, to take advanced degrees in theology. And to become a doctor in theology in those days, you had to go through 5 steps. You became a biblicus, then a sententiarius, then you became had a disputation for the formatus degree, and then came licentiatus, and finally you got your doctorate. That usually took 7 or 8 years. Now, this involved a lot of things that are rather interesting, insofar that disputations were a form of instruction in medieval universities ever since the University of Paris. That was one way of educating people, and there were 3 different kinds of disputations. There was a student practice disputation that had nothing but just a practice in front of students in the dormitory. Then there was a promotional disputation where a man came up for a degree. And when you wanted to get this biblicus degree, you had to actually engage in a disputation. Then as you went on from there, you had a disputation in connection with each one. What I was trying to say is this. Luther, when he nailed his 95 theses, was engaging in a 3rd type of disputation. I've translated the Wittenberg Statutes, which, by the way, no one has ever translated. They're still in Latin, and apparently nobody touches them. At any rate, in that it tells about this type of disputation. You'd have to pay $200 fine if you didn't dispute at least once a year. And this was an instructional thing, like maybe we'd have a debate today on Iran. And this was a timely subject, so Luther drew up the 95 theses with the idea of having a nice academic discussion. And in this, they would gather in the castle church, and in the back of the castle church, they had a catheter on which the top man sat that ran the disputation, and then 3 other professors down below. And they gathered in a kind of a circle around him, and there were 2 on one side and 2 on the other side of students, and the poor candidate stood in the middle, and he had to take all the cross-firing and was supposed to record in his mind what had been said, and then finally he was supposed to make a beautiful summation of that and thank the audience for its gracious tolerance, according to the statute. But at any rate, when Luther nailed the 95 Theses, he did not draw up those theses from the angle that most people have thought, that he believed everything that was in the theses. You had to draw up theses so that both sides could argue. So when Luther said, why doesn't the Pope take the poor souls out of hell out of purgatory without charging? He merely wanted this to be a good bait for the opposite side, don't you see? Well, at any rate, Luther wrote to Schurl over in Nuremberg. He said, I nailed the theses, but I had no takers. And one of the old lawyers in the law department passed him in the street, and he said, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to start some kind of a rumpus with Rome? Well, nobody wanted to touch this hot potato, so there was no debate. Otherwise, it would have had to been sometime in November, because, you see, they were nailed right at the time of All Saints' Day, and you couldn't have the debate right away, so this was an announcement that they wanted to have a debate. Well, then Luther made the very sad mistake of sending this to Albert of Mainz, who was, of course, very angry that the bottom was dropping out of his real estate investment, so that it didn't get very far. It went to Rome, and then he was in trouble. Well, now I want to say a little about Luther. Since we announced this with a lecture on Luther, I want to say a little bit more about him in detail. Martin Luther the man, Luther as a human being and as a theologian and one of the great men of history. Unfortunately, this is a real problem. It wasn't any problem when I wrote that master's thesis, because I was then, like most people that write biographies, I assumed that what was in the source materials was true. But when you actually start getting into this, you realize that only one painter has given us the best he could produce. Lucas Cranach. Dürer never got around to it. Holbein the Younger, who painted those beautiful pictures of his day, portraitures of Henry VIII and others, he could have done a nice job. And Dürer also did a nice job on Melanchthon. Melanchthon looks like a dried up prune in the other painting, while the one that Dürer did has the bulging forehead, and really you can see why he's a man of genius. He has capability. Particularly Luther's eyes were a problem. And I don't know how a painter paints eyes, but it's hard to paint eyes like Luther had. Unfortunately, too, the descriptions by contemporaries, and we have, I'd say about 8 or 9 by those that were friendly toward Luther, and we have about 4 or 5 that are hostile. But unfortunately, Luther's friends took him for granted. And I'm even thankful to this day that Melanchthon one time on the side said, Luther's eyes are brown and they have gold rings around the outside. There are things like this. You have descriptions of him by students and by others that apparently knew him quite well. That his eyes were very unusual and that he was a very unusual person, but really there isn't too much that is helpful. And his enemies, of course, couldn't see anything but the devil, some kind of an animal, like an obelisk. They even said that Luther is like an obelisk. He crawls up on a poor bird slowly, hypnotizes him, and then he becomes a Lutheran. Well, I have tried to put all this material together, these caricatures that were created by the enemies, of course, are not helpful at all. But I assume that Luther was a man of about middle height, 5'10". He was not too heavy in the beginning. When he was in the monastery, he was pretty thin. Mosellanus tells us that the Leipzig debate, every bone in his body could be numbered. Apparently, however, after he broke up with the monastic fasting and he married Katie, and she fed him pretty well, then Heinrich Boehmer says Luther began to take on a befitting plumpness, whatever that means. At any rate, I have tried to estimate how heavy Luther was, and I imagine that in the beginning he weighed about 145 pounds, and maybe at best 175. Now we have to also remember that most of the Luther pictures that you see are by Lucas Cranach the Younger, and they're from imagination, particularly the older paintings. And when you put a gown on a man, we're all familiar with that as clergymen, that you make a man look heavier when you put a gown on him. So that I don't think that the Luther of life was ever over 175 pounds. His eyes are something that attracted everybody. And they played a tremendous role in lecturing and in preaching. Some say that when he preached on Sunday and he looked at the congregation, he could see everything that you'd done during the week. He looked right through you. And the students say that there was such a piercing type of look in his eye that the students in the classroom also noticed this. But apparently it didn't bother them from the angle of being afraid of him. He seems to have been liked very much by students. But Cajetan, you know, said that that bestia, that beast, he has strange, pierced-looking eyes, and strange ideas flit through his head. So, you have Aleander, who was the nuncio at Worms, tells how Luther got out of the carriage with three other men, and he stood there, and he looked over the audience with his demonic eyes, and one priest came up to him and touched his gown like they touched the gown of Jesus, you know, hoping to get a healing by just touching him. So you can see how prejudiced that kind of thinking was. Luther, in addition to this, if you take his qualities as a professor and as a preacher, had a tremendous memory. It's one of those memories that come seldom in a century. I took courses in Virgil too, as you probably did, and Cicero, but Luther later on could still quote these. And one reason why Luther was able to write 350 tracts is because he would take a goose quill pen and run off a text. One of them, I have estimated, he wrote in 3 days, and it's about 270 pages in print. And he says, I never correct, because when the Holy Spirit guides me in writing, I don't think I should change it. But later on in life, he also said, I think most of these things should be burned, because the students that study the Reformation will never understand me, because most of my writings were dealing with specific problems. So you see, if they don't know the problems, they don't know why I said what I did. So if I wrote to, let us say, a hostile enemy who had written a real sharp tract against him, and then the answer very often explained that. Then Luther also had unusual spiritual qualities. There must be some reason why all the reformers of that period talked to him about being the father. He was a father to all the Wittenberg faculty. He was just a natural leader. And Urbanus Regius was with Luther at the Cobourg when Melanchthon was up against that tremendous problem, crafting the Augsburg Confession with old Eck staring at him and having drawn up 404 theses that he was supposed to answer of Lutheran abuses, and the princes looking over his shoulder, and Philip of Hesse not agreeing with the Elector of Saxony, Luther was very disturbed about all this because he knew how weak Philip was when it came to facing opposition. And Regius walked past Luther's door, and he thought there was somebody in the room because he heard him talk. Then he listened for a while through the door. He noticed that Luther was pleading with God to give Philip the strength that he was facing, that he needed to face the situation at Augsburg. At any rate, that was one occasion that I want to cite. Another occasion was when Melanchthon was very ill. He thought he was going to die. And Luther stood at the window and pleaded with God to save Philip. And Philip adds in his source that he prayed me back to life. So, this man, when he got into the pulpit, had but a brief outline. We wouldn't have his sermons had not two or three other, I suppose you call them 16th century shorthand writers, been in the audience and taken down the sermons. He would get there with just a brief outline, and we're told by some of the students that heard him, he said he could unfold a text and it was just so smooth and fine that you thought he had it all written out and memorized. And then he could impersonate all the characters that were involved. One minute he could be the devil. The next minute he could be somebody else. And he shifted back and forth, and he just had the congregation holding it in the hollow of his hand. So he was really, apparently, quite an unusual individual. And the same thing applied to his classroom activities. I don't know how much you followed recent developments in Germany. See, I was in the occupation for 2 years and learned to know a lot of Roman Catholics. I was over the Church of Bavaria and was also at Erlangen, and through that and through my foundation work, I became acquainted with a lot of prominent Roman Catholics. One of the ones that I've admired has been Joseph Lortz. Joseph Lortz started his investigations of Luther and his life in 1915. Like any Roman Catholic, he had a lot of difficulty because you have a lot of obstacles when you use Roman sources. By 1539, he came out with his first biography, and then Die Reformation in Deutschland, and then he went on, and in that particular approach in 39, he still says, well, Luther was a great man, but he was not what you would call a first-class theologian, because he'd never dug into Luther from the angle of theology, had merely read biographies. So then he starts out and begins to, I suppose, through the influence of Walter von Leeuwenhoek and some other scholars, he begins to, and also his pupils helped in this, he begins to sink himself into Luther's writings, sermons. And then he publishes another work in 49, another one in the early 50s, How the Reformation Came. That's printed in English. Well, that is still not quite mature. But in 69, he finally wrote his definitive view of Luther, Martin Luther, and Reformata Reformanda, that one of his own pupils had published as a festschrift, Iselo. And in this, I want to read from this two quotations. I wish I could read 20 to you because they are really revealing. Here's what he says. I quote, Luther is a spiritual giant, or, in case we quote Althaus, an ocean. And the danger lies in getting drowned in its waters. The danger lies in that one does not master Luther sufficiently, both because of the massiveness of the material and its uniqueness, that I found to be true too. Simo justus et peccator. You see, that is typical of Luther. Man is just, and at the same time, he's a sinner. A little later in another section of this, he says, it is almost a commonplace, yet it should be repeated. Luther belongs to the highest gallery of men that have been unusually creative in power, and is a genius in the highest sense. He possesses originality both in the religious realm and in the field of theological exposition. In the end, he finally concludes that there isn't really too much difference between Lutherans and Catholics on justification by faith, that the little dogs that yipped around Luther's feet during the Reformation didn't understand what it was all about. You should never have excommunicated him. And he says even, I wish that we could today incorporate what Luther wrote in the Roman Catholic Church. It would really be wholesome for us. So you see, he's really gone very far in his evaluation. When you consider that he's a Dominican, I might state that when I was teaching at the University of Iowa, one time the students walked out and I had two of these Jesuits in class. And one of the graduate students told me afterwards he was walking behind the Jesuits and they were talking to each other about the lecture. And said, what do we do now? He quotes nothing but Dominicans. So you see, this is something that has happened in Germany. Now I'd like to turn to the University of Wittenberg and deal a little with the matter of Luther's own transformation into a reformer and make some observations in regard to some modern writings that I think are off base, and show that you can't really analyze Luther unless you take also the history of the University of Wittenberg into consideration. You know that Luther became a professor in place of Staupitz at Wittenberg, lectura in Biblia, 1512. Then something very amazing happens to Luther that could never be understood unless you grant that Luther was a genius. Remember, Luther had been thoroughly schooled in Lombard sentences. He knew them practically by heart. That's the four-volume textbook of Roman Catholic dogmatics. Treats the history of dogma clear from the fallen angels, clear to the final judgment. He had a master of that to be engaged in the disputations. And when he took his doctor's degree, he had to engage in a circular disputation in which he defended Lombard sentences and used the typical medieval dialectics. Now, do you think he could throw that off in just a short time? Well, this involves a lot of problems. For example, there's been a big argument over when did Luther have the Turmeligness. And Ernst Bitzer has tried to show that he found in Romans still a lot of Demut, and that man was saved by having Demut. Well, what does he expect? Luther had been a monk since 1505. Did he expect him to throw off all this just overnight? No, Luther says late in life when he wrote the introduction to volume 1 of his Latin works, he said, Dann hatte ich nur die Erstlinge. I had only the first inklings. And I agree with I have a treatise here by Siggins, John Siggins, J.A.N. Siggins. And he says, yes, he had the first inklings. But that didn't mean that he was rid of all the background that he'd gotten. Suppose he graduated from Corey Seminary and just drop everything overnight. You can't do that. Then you have to consider, when you go to the University of Wittenberg and read its history, you have to remember that Luther didn't seriously start studying Greek until 1514. Started studying Hebrew in 1516. And then, because he studied, that doesn't mean that he knew Greek well. When he brings Melanchthon there and brings other professors in Hebrew there, Luther actually sits down in the classroom of Philip Melanchthon when he's lecturing after he got there in 1518 to learn still more Greek. So you have a formative period there in Luther's life that has to be adjusted to his own inner development. You can't take an exegetical approach to Luther's discovery of Tormeliveness and on the basis of that alone arrive at the conclusion that takes place. Sigins says, Luther rethought this very often. I grant he was more mature around 15, 18, and 19 when he gave this four series of lectures. Remember, he lectured first on the Psalms and then on Romans, then Galatians, Hebrews. He's unfolding all the time, but he's still got a lot of that past background in him. He has to slough off what he learned before. And the more Greek he learns, the more Hebrew he learns, the better qualified he is to see that he's right. So that it isn't really strange that in Luther's development there would be not a clarity right away. But the interesting thing is that quite early he's beginning to realize that their real problem is that Roman Catholicism has combined Aristotle with theology and created an ally which is really in many ways not Christian. So Luther then begins to engage in disputations with his students where he presides and they are the students. So in 1516, now see, this is quite early, 1516, he has Bartholomeus Bernhardi argue with Karlstadt and Lupinus, and they attack scholasticism. So that this is already, you might say, a revelation of what's going on in his classroom. Well, Karlstadt represented the four faculty members in the Via Antiqua and the Thoman point of view. While in the next debate, he had Amstorff in there, who was really a Scotist and in charge of the three additional Scotists. So you have here an argument with the actual philosophical faculty, don't you see, by these students. And they made such fools of the theological faculty that Karlstadt was enraged. He went to the neighboring Leipzig, bought himself a whole set of Augustine to see whether they were right, and then he came to the conclusion that he'd been all wrong. But he didn't want to grant that he'd really been a fool. So he goes to Italy, buys a doctor's degree in law, and marches on the Wittenberg campus with the new gown, a doctor in law. I wish I had time to analyze Karlstadt. Karlstadt is an interesting character. And most of the modern scholars that have written about him that are just secular historians don't understand Karlstadt at all. Karlstadt is a very jealous person. He's the one that actually gave Luther his doctor's degree. He was the one that carried on the ceremonies. And he couldn't take it that this young student was all at once becoming so famous. And he was trying in every way, trying to get his deanship again, get the deanship over and over. I think he was dean five times between 1512 and 1520. By the way, I translated the Liber Decanorum, in which all this stuff is found about the dean's records. Well, Luther then, after these debates, can write John Lang, and he says, our theology in Augustine is continuing to prosper and reign in our university through the hand of God. Aristotle is declining daily and heading for a fall, and which will end him forever. It is remarkable how the lectures on Lombard sentences are despised. No one can hope to get an audience unless he promises to lecture on this new theology. That is, on the Bible, St. Augustine, or one of the ecclesiastical authorities of the early church. So you see what's happening right in the classroom is in the same direction that Luther's own unfolding is taking place. Well, then Luther began to realize he would get nowhere in this whole thing unless actually Wittenberg became an exegetical institution. And here's where the remarkable thing about Luther comes in. He changes from a woodchopper, as Heinrich Bermer says, a scholastic who works with Lombard sentences, to one in which you actually now are discarding the four senses of Scripture and you're using a whole new approach to theology. Well, he wrote the Elector several letters. He said, what we need is not only that we study Greek and Hebrew, but our students need to study it. So we have to have professors in those fields. So he contacts the Elector and says, we need somebody in Greek. Well, the Elector was trying to see what he could do, and Lutheran also tried to see whether they could find a man. They had Marcellanus come down from Leipzig. They didn't particularly like him. And then the Elector was trying to get John Reuchlin. Well, John Reuchlin was apparently too old. He didn't want to make that long trip. But at any rate, he recommended Philip, who was his grandnephew. And Philip, he says, next to Erasmus, is the greatest Greek scholar in Germany. I've read that letter again recently that he wrote in the Corpus Reformatorum. At any rate, they are able to get Melanchthon then. And this involves then a great deal that has been misunderstood. For example, there have been treatises by Maria Grossman of Harvard and Junghans of East Germany. They are trying to overplay. They just don't understand the university history, and so they're trying to overplay that Greek and perhaps some Hebrew was already a carryover from Erfurt. And they're trying to make out that it happened much earlier than what it did. Well, if they knew how degrees were granted, and that people who on the side were studying a little Greek with Marshak and others, that was just a sideline. That had nothing to do with their academic promotion. If you wanted to become a doctor in theology, you could do only one thing: travel the road of Biblicus, those different degrees. And that involved a mastery of Lombard and scholasticism. That's the reason Luther wants scholasticism out and start this new approach. Well, then the interesting thing is that when Melanchthon then did come, that he and Luther fell so in love with each other that they can't say enough along the line of praise for one another. Well, Melanchthon has been pretty thoroughly re-studied in recent decades. Barton has a very fine exegetical study. Barton has pointed out that Melanchthon, during the period that Luther was at Worms and following, gave 28 courses, theological courses, at Wittenberg, lecture courses, and that he more or less had to take over because Luther was so preoccupied with Rome and all the difficulties that he had. However, Luther then decided that since they had Melanchthon, he would go right to the classroom and learn with the students from Melanchthon the Greek. And the amazing thing to me is that Melanchthon would even prepare his own text in Greek together with a little dictionary in the back that the students used to get them properly prepared to use an exegetical approach. Well, we have then also works by Green, who studied with Ehlert. Stoppelrich has put out material on Melanchthon. Wilhelm Maurer has two very fine two volumes on a biography of Melanchthon. And then Heinz Scheible now has been made the editor of the Melanchthon letters. So they're going to re-edit the material that's in the Corpus Reformatorum and actually have a new edition, of which I already have two volumes, which probably should also be in the seminary library, because it gives you much new material. They found something like 600 or 800 letters that were never known before, that families had, that had been sent in because they set up this institute at the University of Heidelberg. Now, Luther talked Melanchthon into taking a biblicus degree in theology. So he became a biblicus, and that's the reason he could deliver those lectures. Now they were also ready to drop canon law, Lombard sentences, and in place of Lombard sentences, which is a collection of dogmatics, treatises, they were going to now use a new publication that Melanchthon put out, his Lotzi. So the Lotzi is the first attempt at a dogmatics book by the Wittenberg faculty, and Luther praised Melanchthon for doing this, because then they could get rid of Lombard and they wouldn't have to use that. Well, they also started a boys' school. Boys were put into a pedagogium where they were supposed to learn languages. How am I coming on time?
Oh, by all means, continue.
All right.
Sure.
In the dormitories, they arranged that conversation could only be in Latin. If you spoke any German, you'd be fined. And they had rectorian in the various dormitories that were supposed to see to it that only Latin was spoken. They also had declamations, and Melanchthon, to really show them how to do it, would take speeches of Demosthenes in Greek and deliver them in front of the whole student body, which we call declamations. And they had to do that once a year, and then he got them also to write their own treatises in Greek and deliver them, that is the advanced students, so that they would learn how to handle the language. Now, Wittenberg's enrollment by now had grown a great deal because Luther was very popular, and Spalatin visited Wittenberg in 1520, and he went to Melanchthon's classroom, and he found he had 600 students that listened to his lectures, and Luther could get only 400 into his Große Hörsaal, and I've been in there and I've been trying to estimate how much that would hold, and I don't see how they could even get 400 in there. The room was not very large. At any rate, apparently both of them were so popular that the students just flocked there. Let me read you a quotation by Thomas Blauer in 1520, who wrote it to his brother in Konstanz. "Recently I confessed to Luther, who had admonished us to attend communion. Formerly, we confessed to Melanchthon, who has given himself entirely to the study of the Holy Scriptures, to which he is trying to lead the students. The result is that there are practically no students who do not go around with a Bible in hand, a fact that has even impressed me. Luther is lecturing on the Psalms, and while Melanchthon is treating St. Paul. Melanchthon is, so to say, Luther's traveling companion in Christ. Same enthusiasm unites the two, the same reliability as scholars, same working together in all their undertakings and teachings." Another quotation, one of the students writes, "I consider myself fortunate that under God's guidance, I have come to the place where it seems to me One learns the Christian religion right, and where the only man is living who really understands the Bible, a fact that I daily witness here. Well, then, you know, came Worms. Decet condemned Luther from Rome, 1521. And this came as really a blight to the university. It was really a victory for the Altgläubigen. And you now, after that, had really a real problem, because all the conservative Catholic princes withdrew their student support. And Wittenberg dropped in enrollment to about one-fifth of what it had been. And they were very concerned that the university might go under. Meanwhile, Luther is at the Wartburg, starts translating the New Testament. Melanchthon tries to carry on. And then, as though that weren't enough, you have also the Zwickau prophets coming and disturbing Wittenberg. Walter Kirler says it was like a white frost on the Reformation. Well, it wasn't quite as bad as it seemed. The Nuremberg Diets, 1523-24, where they were discussing the carrying out of the Edict of Worms, got nowhere. They finally decided they would hold a meeting at Spire. And at Spire it became so heated that Ferdinand, incidentally the Kaiser was on his honeymoon in Spain, so he wasn't there, so he had to send his brother. Said that when it gets too hot a potato, drop it. And there they could do nothing else but arrive at the old, age-old principle in German history, namely to formulate the principle of cuius regio ius religio. And as a result then, this now gave a green light to the Elector of Saxony to do within his lands what he wanted to. So you get your Saxon visitations. I wish I had time to go into that, the cleaning out of the bad eggs in the church, and it was really bad. Even in the core crash, they found only 94 out of 154 that they could even use. They classified those as first class, second class, third class. And when they went from one place to another, they also found that people would be sitting outside of churches, they wouldn't go to the sermon. And when they were asked by the visitors, why didn't you go? Well, they said, why should we go? Our preacher is preaching about beer and malt and how to make it. And it records that about a third of them lived in wild wedlock. So you had really a situation that one of the visitors, Jonas, called it as a hessische Grundsuppe. I suppose that's the dregs that you get after eating the soup at the bottom. The result was that they had to remove a lot of men and introduce what we call Notprediger. And that, of course, was also a problem, because it was pretty hard to take a man who was a shoester or even a bower to make a preacher out of him. So they had to write special treatises, and Luther's Large Catechism, you know, was meant for that. They were supposed to read that from the pulpit. And they also had Hauspostillen that could be read, where these emergency preachers could get along. Well, the movement then in the 20s is one of keeping busy, trying to make things go. Luther is by now very conscious of the fact that the secret to the Reformation is the Bible. How can you expect believers to know what really they should hold to in their faith if they don't have a book in their own language? So Luther in the 20s then started translating the Old Testament. He'd already done the New Testament at the Wartburg. He and Melanchthon went through it together, and that was published in 22. But the actual Luther Bible then involved all these years from here to almost to Luther's death. Luther did a first translation by the end of the 20s. Then he called together his Sanhedrin, as he called it, and they reviewed it text by text, with Luther turning to the scholars and asking them to read. First he had the secretary read what they discussed the last time, and then he'd call on Melanchthon, or he'd call upon Arrigalus or Cruciger, if they were in the Old Testament, to read the next verse of Job. And then he gave them a chance to express, what does Job actually say in that text? And he would make the circle, let everybody make his contributions. And then Luther would say, Dann sagen wir so in Deutsch. And Luther would come up with what he thought it ought to be in German. Well, you know, the first complete Bible came out in 1534. They did partial revisions, and another complete Bible came out, second revision, in 39. Did some more revising, and finally the final one came out in 45. So that was part of Luther's contribution then during these critical years to get that ready. Well, I haven't time to go into this preparatory work of the students, but Luther and Melanchthon felt that students ought to be trained, and I think here's something that I might mention to the seminary, and I hope it can be re-emphasized. I noticed in the country there is a letting up on languages, which is a very bad thing. Melanchthon says, how can someone, a student, who is not trained in Greek, interpret the Holy Scriptures? Or how can a third theologian understand Hebrew the way it is written in the original language? He said, those who are not trained create more darkness than light. And there's a lot of truth to that. Well, we get then to the end of the 20s, when John is about ready to die, and Luther is John the Constant's father confessor. And here now, John decided to summon his son and the family, and he would draw up his last will. I'm not going to read the whole will, but this is an interesting section of the will, and it shows you also how they were not thinking in terms of the Lutheran Church, but thinking in terms of the restoration of the Bible and the Gospel. After he had that other part of the text, he goes on and says, hence we sound this solemn admonition to our dear son and his loved ones. Their father kindly but most emphatically directs that they uphold the institution of higher learning in Wittenberg regardless of its cost and the energy required. This is to be done to the praise of Almighty God, because in these recent times there has arisen in that place the rich saving grace of the Word of God. Well, John Frederick did exactly what his father suggested, and he came to Wittenberg. First he saw Luther privately, then he met with the whole theological faculty, and then they decided that the whole university needed to be reorganized. Now we're ready for a Lutheran university. In this, after some discussion, they had Melanchthon draft the theses, but not like Monschreck and some others have thought, that Melanchthon drew them up and then the others accepted them. That is contrary to the whole spirit of the Reformation. No, Melanchthon was a fluent writer, and he was a good stylist. So what he put together was what they'd agreed upon. So the statutes then are drawn up, and you find also that they have talked the elector into once more starting academic degrees, because Karlstadt had stopped academic degrees at Wittenberg in 1523, which was very bad. But he had said that God had revealed his wisdom to babes and sucklings, and therefore you shouldn't call anybody but God in heaven doctor, and give him an advanced degree. Well, the elector agreed with this, and so they actually decided to once more have a typical institution like they'd had earlier from the angle of degrees. But in this particular setup now, it's interesting that Melanchthon says, and I haven't the quotation here, but I can summarize it. He says, we are not starting anything new at Wittenberg. We accept all the ecumenical creeds of the early church. We are against all the heresies of the early church. What we are doing is restoring once more the rich grace of God and, you might say, the gospel. Well, then they decided that they would keep 4 degrees out of the training of a doctorate. They were going to keep Biblicus, Sententiarius. He said, we kept that because we didn't know what else to call it, but we haven't got any lumbar anymore. And then Formatus, you know, was just a trial to see whether man had the capability of becoming a doctor. And then finally the doctors. And they said, let him approach the doctorate with a great deal of trepidation and fear, and be a very pious man that really realizes what he's doing. So now you get an actual training in the theological faculty that is based upon a humanistic background in the liberal arts college. There's actually a fine preparation for this. And so when a candidate now comes up in this particular field, a biblicus has to actually get up and exegetically defend any part that they might pick from Romans. So here sits Luther, and the candidate is up, and he says, turn to chapter 6, start reading from the Greek, and then expound it, see? So that actually, not like in the case of Lombard, where you've memorized all the answers, and you, with dialectical skill, defend anything that might be thrown in your direction. So he now is able to interpret Romans. Sententiarius was supposed to cover St. Paul's writings, the Psalms, and the prophets. Then finally, for the doctorate, of course, you were supposed to engage in a circular disputation and also supposed to be able to answer any part to any part of the Bible. I'd like to add one little thought here that comes to my mind that I think is very interesting. I used to think, and I suppose I've often said that in lecture, that Luther was a Pauline theologian. Maybe you've heard this. I'd like to add that Luther preached between 400 and 500 sermons on the Gospel of St. John that we have. 1/5 of his whole total sermon preaching is from the Gospel of St. John. And Luther held that certain parts of the Bible were far more important for their doctoral candidates than other portions. So he wanted you to be well informed on St. Paul's lectures, I mean St. Paul's letters. You're supposed to know John very well. You're supposed to know St. Peter's epistle and the joint epistles, and Genesis, Psalms, and the prophecies. So a complete theologian was noted to know all these fields. Well, now I suppose that, how much time have I got left? Worn them out?
We're coming very close to the end.
Yeah, well, I want to tell you a little about some very unusual post-Reformation developments. You know, there was a lot of talk years ago, and I often wondered about it, how true it was, about the crypto-Calvinism that came into Saxon lands after the Reformation. It is true that Calvin is a second generation theologian, and he lives almost to the end of this period that I'm talking about. And he did write a number of letters to Melanchthon, and was quite sure in his own mind that Melanchthon was similar to himself in many ways. Well, I don't think this is quite correct, but apparently that is one of the factors that entered this period of confusion, because there was a great battle between the two universities of Jena and Wittenberg, and as a result, there came a great deal of confusion. When we didn't really know too much about the details, much has been written about the doctrinal development in the Formula of Concord and so forth, and we know something about those reformers, but we never had really first-hand information. Then, after World War number two, Patton was going through Thuringia and discovered in the salt mines of Thuringia a part of the Berlin Library that had been put there for safekeeping. In fact, they put the Berlin Library in, also in the Russian zone, and it was really spread a great deal according to Germans. But at any rate, he found 1,700,000 volumes of rare works in this salt mine. He ordered trucks to load these rare books into the trucks and haul them to Marburg, and they had an empty building. They put them in what was known as the Westdeutsche Bibliothek. I worked in this Westdeutsche Bibliothek too when I was with the foundation. In fact, we filmed 66,000 pages out of that collection. It was without a catalog, and you had to just go around and roam around and pick what you could find, because the catalog had been lost. The local Marburg professor, Thomas Klein, also did browsing, and he came across a manuscript that had been written by Ubon Pierius, a Wittenberg professor, during the time of the period that we're interested in, namely the Formula of Concord period. And Ubon Pierius, who took the name from the... his German name was Birnebaum, and the Latin for it was Pyrrhus. So he called himself Pierius. So Ubon Pierius was really the dean of the theological faculty. Well, now I don't know whether you want to take the time to go into this, but this is really a revealing document. I wrote a review of it in the Erasmus publication, a review of about 6 pages, a European publication. And I have the volume, it's about 600 pages. And the material comes right out of the archives of the princes. The whole inside story. Now, to make this story short, and if you want to discuss it, I'll be glad to enlarge on it, but I don't want to draw upon your patience. But in this, actually, it becomes clear that there was a great deal of strife over the Augsburg Confession, over the Formula of Concord, especially in different lands in northern Germany, and for that matter, even some in southern Germany, where Hans Jonas Prinz had been. But at any rate, be that as it may, it has some very revealing information about what actually did happen at Wittenberg. The Elector Christian apparently had all the Lutheran people removed from the school and put in Calvinists, out-and-out Calvinists. And Pierius was the dean, and he was also the superintendent of Electoral Saxony. They took the Dachreiter off of the town church that told during communion. They actually started removing altars from churches, put in tables like Calvin had, and they began to pervert the whole thing. They would preach sermons from the same pulpit from which Luther had preached, in which they made fun of Andrea. They said, well, you know, Andrea says that Christ is everywhere, so he must be in manure, he must be in almost any kind of dirt, you know. And really poke fun in front of the student body about what Luther had taught on baptism and on the Lord's Supper. And of course, it had a Calvinistic approach to the natures of Christ, and I haven't got time to go into that. But at any rate, as though that wasn't enough, they took the Luther Bible, started reprinting it, and Krell ordered that they were supposed to put in between the lines the Calvinistic explanation where Luther had translated. They'd give the Lutheran text and then explain in Calvinistic form what the meaning was, see? So that you actually get a terrible situation. Well, Christian the First was an alcoholic. Unfortunately, he died in 1591. And then really the blow came, because the Lutherans now, naturally, because he was out, and the power had passed from there to Thuringia, to the other line of princes, because his boys were so young that they couldn't take over. So it went over to the other line. And you start now getting that conservative reaction. Krell is publicly executed, his head cut off in Dresden. Pierius, locked up in jail, went through many inquisitions, and that's all in that book, what they asked him and so forth. And also, Paul, who was court preacher, a number of the others were all in custody. And what I'm trying to say is, because of this situation, you get in Lutheranism a terrible reaction, which actually helps bring on some of the things that we've got today in our midst. We get a 16th century approach first in Luther's day, and much of what is being done here now becomes extreme, and they don't even fully understand Luther. You get really the Luther separated from the Luther of life. You get a dogmatic Luther, and Luther was dogmatic, but you lose the spiritual Luther. You lose the other side of Luther, the Luther that really made Luther of the Reformation. Luther was a great gospel preacher. He was a fine Seelsorger. He was an excellent person to go to and talk things over with. If he summoned you to communion on Saturday night before you went to church, he might say, "Henry, is your life as good as it ought to be? Do you think you should go to communion?" And if there was anything in the record that was against him, he would advise not to go. So you see, what I'm saying is, the 17th century becomes the age of dogmatism, probably in the main reason, because of this extreme trial that they went through, and it was terrible. Well, I thank you for your patience. I hope that I've said some things that are useful.